It's time to wake to sleep with the number one sleep authority, Sleep Science Today, and Sleep Better Tonight.
Welcome to Sleep Science Today. I am your host, Andrew Kolsky. On Sleep Science Today, we talk about sleep and all the science behind sleep. Today, we have an actual very special guest. Her name is Katherine Hansen, and she is the executive director of the Society of Behavioral Sleep Medicine. And for those of you listening to this show, you probably never heard of that, but you're going to learn a lot about it because it's important in the sleep community. So that's enough that I'm going to say right now, and I want to introduce Katherine. Katherine, thank you for joining us.
Oh, what a pleasure, Andrew, and I'm so grateful that we can share about this Society of Behavioral Sleep Medicine to your audience. They'll enjoy listening, I know.
Yeah, I think this is going to be really informative for a lot of people, and there's probably a lot of listeners who may consider joining once they learn more about what this is all about. So to kick us off here, you're the executive director. Tell us, where did your interest come from in the concept of sleep in the first place that ultimately led you into this position?
Oh, I've had a very interesting journey. I started out at Mayo Clinic in 1966 doing research in epilepsy, during which we identified that there were certain awakenings coming out of this quiet phase of which we defined as sleep later, but it was a quiet phase, and just looked at the frequency analyses and something was different. So I called my colleague who is a researcher with me and I said, I think there's something we need to drill into here because I'm seeing this pathway evolve with the epilepsy patients, and there's something unique about it. And so we identified through signal averaging, which you now call AI today, but we identified from many patients a database where we then ran it through the averager, and we found that there were certain epochs over certain periods of time. And that's how we then began to say, I think there's quiet sleep and active sleep, but now let's define what constitutes quiet sleep and what constitutes deep sleep, because we knew there were frequency distributions that were very different and physiological processes that went with each of those differential states. It wasn't until much later that we were able to wrap our arms around what it's meant to have active sleep, which we then called REM sleep. Of course, now we know many different reasons for it. But the REM sleep, we couldn't really say it was rapid eye movement that was the characteristic. We saw an unusual waveform in the posterior derivations, the occipital region, that were called lambdoids and PGO spikes. And it wasn't until we ran it again through our signal averager that over many, many samplings of these frequencies that we started to see the correlation. Something strange is going on with eyes. And that's when we went to the next phase of differential of stages of sleep.
Wow.
So from that, then we started to apply it in a more clinical sense. But that took a few years, and by that time I'd already departed Mayo Clinic, and I had gone to the University of Colorado Med Center, and I had the privilege of working nights because I had gone back to school, and I wanted to learn trauma. I wanted to know the full circle of medicine. And I had an opportunity to engage with another study. And that was the seminal study that identified the relationship between cardiac arrhythmias and REM stage of sleep. And it was done right in the intensive care unit. And it was on fresh MIs that we admitted through the emergency room.
Oh, wow.
So you can imagine the impact that had on care, the care continuum, and the real bewitching hours of the early morning and what transpires in those early morning hours. And what was also another takeaway with that was it was an observational study. When are we most fatigued and less responsive? When we're caring for patients on night shift, probably at the same time that the arrhythmias were at their peak. I saw VTAC, I saw systole, SVTs. It was really amazing the distribution of anomalies that you would see. And so one of the takeaways from that was not just the physiological relationship, but it was the safety of the patient. We also used that to apply, from a risk perspective, medication errors, and those peaked at that time of morning. Now we're talking about a longitudinal application, which over my career, I used that information about 25, 30 years down the stream to do risk aversion in a large corporation that I worked with. And we identified a lot of opportunity to reduce risk and still care for the patient. So that's kind of a landscape of where I've come from. And then I decided that it was probably time to leave the clinical side. And I was recruited to join the behavioral side. But I had worked with a lot of psychologists, and I also had a background in psych. So it was really a lot of fun for me to see the other side, the sleep wellness side.
Right, right. Well, that's it's an amazing background, and you know what a perfect guest to be describing these things to us, because you've lived it, you've been there, and I mean sleep medicine itself really started to become a thing unto itself in what, mid-60s, late-60s?
Well, it really was more from a neurology perspective then. That's when we saw the narcolepsies and we saw very few breathing disorders. It wasn't until 81 when Sullivan from Canada posted his first CPAP device for FDA approval. Mm-hmm. And that didn't, I think that was beginning of 82 when he finally got it. Interesting that we might be talking about that, because I had already developed a sleep clinic in 81. And we had psychologists that staffed with us, along with electrophysiology, cardiology, psych. My medical director was a preeminent psychiatrist for the Department of Justice. And we saw a lot of breathing disorders that it was difficult for us to know what to do, because there was no real care planning. There was no real evidence of research and practice guidelines for that. Mm-hmm. So I decided I had this engineer from IBM who had acromegaly. And so he had a thick tongue and a very narrowed airway, posterior pharyngeal airway. And he and I were talking about this pathway called the posterior airway obstruction. And he said, you know what you really need is a reverse vacuum cleaner. And I said, I've got just the idea. I called Sullivan in Canada and I said, I'd like one of your devices. And he sent me one. And so my engineer took it apart and put it back together again. He said, I'll teach you how to use it. And sure enough, we had success with managing splinting his airway. And that was the beginning of our awareness. And by that time, it was 82. And pulmonologists joined us, and we started to really open up the opportunity for a diverse patient assessment and treatment practice with many wonderful specialists.
And this is, I think this is one of the most interesting things about the concept of sleep and sleep issues, is because you have such a cross-section of disciplines. You have pulmonologists, you have neurologists, you have primary care, you have, now we have special, you know, sleep doctor, sleep MD specialists. And then you have this entire other side, which we're going to talk about in a minute. And so you have so many different disciplines all, you know, focused on some aspect or other of sleep-related disorders. And I don't know that there's any other thing or a discipline out there that really crosses as much. Maybe there is, but maybe I'm biased towards sleep.
Oh, no, I think you bring a very important statement to that and awareness to that. One of the things in the hospital when I was teaching nurses about sleep medicine, because we had an inpatient-outpatient program, and at any one time, we could have upwards of 50 portable monitors on our patients that are getting opioids, because our anesthesiologist at that time wanted to reduce the risk from hyposomnolence and decrease respiratory drive due to pain control. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting because I keep saying to the nurses, you know, sleep is a confluence of the systems. You've got your cardiovascular, your neuro, your pulmonary, and your behavioral system, if you want to speak of it that way. One can't function with the other without managing sleep dysfunction on its pathway to sleep wellness. And so it really has to have that whole behavioral construct, because even then we would see, of course, what we call today as COMISA, but it was anxiety and depression that was sabotaging our ability to see a full, actualize a treatment plan and a benefit for the patient. And that's one of the reasons that we brought our psychologist in early, is because in case conference, they brought awareness to us that you can't just treat the medical side. You can't use just drugs and appliances and injections. You have to have the behavioral side. Otherwise, you're not seeing the full opportunity for compliance to therapy and the reduction of barriers to the will for therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is where it becomes, to me, you know, very unique and interesting, because of the number of different disciplines that are all relevant and necessary, and the number of people who are coming at sleep from these different perspectives, but ultimately now we have these more standardized studies. We understand more because there's been more research. We understand different types of treatments that we didn't know of, obviously, in the beginning. And you have a lot of different types of practitioners practicing. And so we're at a point where we need to take a commercial break, but when we come back, I'd love to start talking about, really, if you could give us sort of a 101 level explanation of what would somebody expect if they went to an MD practicing sleep medicine versus a behavioral sleep provider. So we're going to talk about that with Catherine Hansen as soon as we come back from our break on Sleep Science Today.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
All right, we are back from our break. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. This is Sleep Science Today. We're talking with Katherine Hansen. She's the Executive Director of the Society of Behavioral Sleep Medicine. And before the break, we were going to start talking about a little bit bigger explanation of sleep MD versus behavioral versus all the different disciplines. So, Katherine, you're the expert here. I'm going to let you guide us through this.
Oh, well, thank you. I think we're all experts in what this constitutes. But I think let's talk about one of the most classic cases in which you can't separate the mind and the body and the spirit. You have to consider it as a whole person. Mm-hmm. And that would be sleep apnea is so common, and it's very much it's a medical disorder, but there's a behavioral construct as well. So let's look at it from a medical. You would definitely, it's a breathing disorder. So you would look for endoscopy, look at the airway, the back of the airway, and let's see, is it narrow? Is there a cancer growing? Is there an enlarged tonsillar palate, and is there maybe a narrow a fat tongue or a thick tongue, or maybe there's characteristics of a nodule in the nose that impacts the airway. So you can't ignore, you need the visuals to see that. So that might be your endoscopy, it might be an x-ray, it might be other types of radiographic procedures. And then you also have to have a very clear assessment of the oral pharyngeal airway. That's the front and the back and the nose. You can't eliminate that. So you have the physician who does an assessment of it and looks into that space. Sometimes there's an otoscope, ophthalmoscope possibly. But you have to visualize it. Mm-hmm. At times there might be a facet where maybe it's associated with co-occurring conditions such as diabetes, cardiovascular insufficiency, cardiac arrhythmias. Maybe with diabetes there is an elevated A1C3 level. All of those require a medical intervention. So how do you treat diabetes? Well, there might be nutritional supplements, it might be diet restrictions, it might be a drug that is used to manage the sugar levels. It's comprehensive. You have to have that medical expertise. But then let's take that and let's look at that as a co-occurring behavioral facet. So one could have anxiety about it. I'm sure that it's frequent where you say people who don't know better that say, well, you could die from that. So then that creates a whole nother anxiety. Do I lie down and sleep? No, I'll be afraid I won't awaken. And then you've got the myths. Well, my grandma, my grandfather, my parents all snore. Why should that be a problem? I mean, it's just normal, isn't it? Not really. It's worthy of investigation. And there are secondary reasons to consider the impact of snoring left untreated. Mm-hmm. Let's take another side of that. Then there could be depression. You know, when you're tired and you're sleep deprived, you don't feel perky. I personally feel a little funky, and I think that could be construed as depression. Maybe it's not organic, maybe it is. How do you know? You need to see the expert. And that's where your behaviorists come in. So those can sabotage effective management on either side, under either the allopathic or the medical side or the behavioral side. Another is, okay, so you identify that there is a behavioral co-occurring symptom or disease. Then what do you do about it? Well, there are therapies, just like there's x-rays and pharmaceuticals, you know, drugs and diagnostic equipment. There's also therapies for behavioral occurrences. Mm-hmm. And that's what we call cognitive and behavioral therapy.
Right.
And those are tools that are used to reframe and review and try to work through the depression, work through the anxiety. What are some of the causes of it? And here is a major crossroads. You can't treat one without the other. And that's pretty much the overlay of why it's important to have your medical colleagues, but it's equally important to have your behavioral colleagues, your cognitive and behavioral therapist, or what we call behavioral sleep medicine. Mm-hmm. That is the solution to effectively managing a host of your sleep dysfunction, your sleep disorders, your sleep diseases.
Right, right. And it's you know, I think it can be understandably confusing to just the layman, because if I'm a person who I notice that lately I'm having trouble sleeping, or maybe I'm waking up earlier than I normally do, and that's becoming a common thing, or, you know, there's something impacting my ability to get restful sleep, and it's now starting to go on for several months. Obviously, I'm going to have questions for myself. Is there some medical condition that's causing this, or what's going on, or why can't I sleep? And I might even be confused, where do I even start? So probably I would go to my primary care and start there. But because of what you just shared, because there could be so many different factors that result in the problem that I'm having, but the cause could be from many different things, that, you know, it's hard to know where to start. And, you know, I'm just thinking to myself about some of the patients that I have, and I do a lot of work with insomnia. But if someone comes and they say, I'm having trouble sleeping, and I wake up a lot in the middle of the night, and I can't, you know, go back to bed, if you just thought about that from a medical perspective, and you started wondering, is there something going on? Like you said, maybe there's a nodule, maybe there's, you know, any host of medical things, and you forget to consider the behavioral side, you might be missing something. And the case that I'm thinking of that really stands out to me is a patient who had all of these problems sleeping, had a trouble going to sleep, couldn't stay asleep. This has been going on for a long time, finally decided to reach out to someone. And of course, you start thinking, like I do an initial assessment, I'm looking for all sorts of things to make sure of what we should be thinking about. And I'm, you know, wondering, it's baffling me. And then eventually we get into the conversation and it turns out, well, also there's this thing where when I go to bed at night, I lock my bedroom door. Well, why do you do that? Well, because there's an individual in the home who is abusive and sometimes will come in the middle of the night and beat me. Now we know why the person's not sleeping. Had nothing to do with any medical issues, but had you not done a full assessment, you might have been looking for all sorts of medical problems and missed the actual, in this case, I'll call it a behavioral response. So it's just really interesting to me that the breadth of what goes on in sleep disorders.
Well, and I think you bring out a really important analogy, because this is what the Society of Behavioral Sleep Medicine is about. And we have a host of great providers, and these are practitioners who are very skilled in their understanding of the intersection of the medical side with the behavioral side. The other is they have tools to use that help you to traverse through this process of unraveling what is the basis for it. What are some of the attributes that need to be addressed? What are some of the myths that need to be unraveled? What are some of the lessons that need to be relearned? In other words, how do you relearn your sleep? Mm-hmm. And this doesn't happen overnight. You know, you didn't learn how not to sleep overnight. You're not going to unlearn how to sleep overnight. It's a pathway. It's a time-sensitive process. But it's also revealing a lot about the individual, about yourself. Mm-hmm. And so it takes an expert to guide you through that process. And that's what the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Society really wants to promote. And we provide a lot of educational opportunities for providers of all disciplines to learn, how do you interface this? What's the arc between the medical and the behavioral? How do you reframe thinking? How do you reframe your perception of your sleep? One of the things that I always am intrigued by is when somebody says, I can't sleep at all in my bed at night. And I'll just, out of curiosity, I'll say, do you sleep on the couch? Oh, yeah, I have no problem falling asleep on the couch. Mm. Okay, that's interesting. And what I've said to friends is, well, you can fall asleep then. It's just you can't fall asleep in your bedroom. Right. Well, I don't know about that. But listen to what is being said. There's a lot of gift. The gift of listening will help unravel where that dysfunction started. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that's what our providers do extraordinarily well. And I'm very fortunate to work with such an esteemed group, because they are the gift to many, that they restore their sleep, and how happy people can become when they do sleep, and how grateful they are for learning how to sleep better.
Right, right. Well, I definitely want to get into that discussion a little deeper right now. Actually, we're going to do it right after our next commercial break, but I want to explore the types of disciplines that people are coming from when they join the Society of Behavioral Sleep Medicine, and I want to understand more about what the different types of programs and certifications and, you know, et cetera, that are offered. So if you bear with me while we take our next commercial break, we'll come back and we'll learn all about the details of who belongs in the Society of Behavioral Sleep Medicine and what types of offerings do you all have. So we'll be right back after this break with Catherine Hansen.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
Okay, we are back on Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and we were just about to talk about the details of the Society of Behavioral Sleep Medicine, who can join, who, you know, what disciplines are there, and what types of services and opportunities are available. So, Catherine, there is nobody better than you who can answer those questions.
Well, thank you, Andrew. Well, we're very fortunate. We have a wide cross-section of disciplines and credentials that participate with the Society of Behavioral Sleep Medicine. And in particular, it's anyone who has a terminal degree that's been had a degree conferred by an accredited academic organization. And they are engaged in the healthcare arena. So we have licensed clinical social workers, we have licensed marriage and family therapists, we have psychologists, we have physicians, we have analysts, data analysts who have a medical background. It's really widespread. And I think that's one of the benefits of why we have such a diverse educational understanding, and we provide a diverse educational opportunity as well. We provide upwards of 30, 35 webinars a year. And they can be from a science and research perspective, from a clinical consultation perspective. We even focus on professional advancement and early career and consultation. We engage the media. How to talk to the media is one of the webinars that we provide. And we also help to learn what are some funding sources from a research perspective. If you're interested in the research side, not the clinical, or maybe you're doing a hybrid, you're doing both research and clinical, then we foster that as well. And so we're very fortunate to have experts willing to present these kinds of topics across the continuum. And our excitement is we get better and better at that, and we have more and more demand for it, and we have more and more opportunity to network with a cross-section of behavioralists that also includes some of our medical counterparts doing the medical side of sleep medicine. Mm-hmm. The other is that we, every year, we provide and support a 2 to 3 day scientific research meeting, and it is so thrilling to go to that meeting. It's very exciting for me to be able to coordinate it because I get to meet all these experts, but more importantly, I get to watch the experts networking, sharing ideas, building each other, learning from each other, and asking good questions. And that is what I think is the hallmark of the Society of Behavioral Sleep Medicine. We're very inclusive and very caring, and we want to be able to advance others through their career trajectory. So to do that, we try to offer specialized webinars, specialized in-person events. One is a graduate, postgraduate course. And this started a few years ago, but it's evolved into be an amazing course, which is not lecture. It's all case conceptualization. So it's a dialogue. So we have facilitated case discussion that's very interactive. And while we initially thought that that would be a nice tool for our board review course, it's evolved. It's gone much farther beyond that. We have individuals who attend because they want to learn how to deal with challenging clinical cases. And the dialogue is rich. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't exclude any credential nor any level of participation. Students, early career, mid-career, our legacy thinkers who are in their advanced career, they attend as well. Likewise, they attend the scientific conference. And that's really where we submit a call for abstracts. So we have our experts provide the education for the scientific conference. We have 2 or 3 keynotes, and then we have our own that present their work. A lot of times it's a data blitz where they present their research, and they have to do that in 7-8 minutes. It's really an exciting time. We also have symposia that are an hour long, and they'll present interesting clinical cases, or maybe it's a new technology, a new therapeutic device. One of them that's gained a lot of interest the last couple of years, and it's again this year, is on those implantable devices for treatment of sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. And why do you suppose that's that's in our network. It's because there's also a cognitive and a behavioral component to the success of that device. Mm-hmm. And so this is really where there's that overarching medical and behavioral that's important to treat the patient. We also have a number of abstracts that are submitted that they present research findings. What a way to grow the clinical side. You have to have the research to grow the clinical side. And many of these are our students and our trainees in our early career that they're wanting to advance their career in behavioral sleep medicine. What a better organization to do it. And we do facilitate that through our experts, our networking, and they're sharing and they're engaging. They're inviting our students to participate. So that's really a lot of the dynamics that we work with.
Mm-hmm. So there's a tremendous amount there, obviously, from the scientific end, which is important for someone in the field to be able to understand, because that's how they're going to, you know how to treat the patients they're working with. But can you tell us a little bit about one other aspect? When you hear about insomnia, for example, is a big one with behavioral sleep, you have everything from a DBSM, which I'll have you explain to us. You have sleep coaches, CBTI coaches. You have a range of different types of titles and practice levels. Can you give the audience a better understanding of what? Some of those different titles they may hear?
Sure, absolutely. And this is through an allied organization. Because of compliance, regulatory compliance, we have another company who manages the credentialing exams, and that's called the Board of Behavioral Sleep Medicine. I happen to serve as the executive director of that as well. And so let's start from the more comprehensive credential, and that's called, it's exam-based. All the exam questions are evidence-based, and they come from peer-reviewed literature. So it's not personal practice. It is guidelines and clinical practice guidelines that are sanctioned by the industry or the community, the experts. And so that exam is a cross-section of proficiency demonstrated in all the therapies that are inclusive in a more broad-based diplomate of behavioral sleep medicine. So it's not focused only on the tools of CBTI or cognitive behavioral therapy. It includes also maybe therapies much for IRT, imagery rehearsal therapy. It can focus on PTSD. There's also narcolepsy there's a therapy for that. And it's a cross section. It's many more disease processes, many more sleep dysfunctions. And so it's more comprehensive. It's also more difficult. It's also more advanced. And that exam is more advanced. But it's also for those who want to have a demonstrated proficiency through the exam that is more broad-based. Mm-hmm. Now, we have a second credential, which is the CBTIC. In other words, Cognitive Behavioral Therapies for Insomnia, and it's focused just on that. So you don't have a broad-based, more advanced type of therapy regimen that would be included in this exam. It's purely focused on the five elements of CBTI. And that has become a real important exam because we have many individuals who work in different clinical environments. They don't need all those other types of tools. They are focusing on CBTI as their main therapeutic regimen. And in particular, this is where a lot of our nurses and nurse practitioners, PAs, and physicians who are working in sleep clinics, medically based sleep clinics are incorporating CBTI as a way of augmenting adherence to therapy and compliance with therapy. And then we have a third that's almost ready to launch. We're just about around the corner from that. And we had a lot of questions about the coaching side. And we've over the years watched the coaching. And we felt that we needed to put some guidelines to it, because sometimes you can get a little wildly. And we wanted to be sure that it was evidence-based, that there was a structure for validating a standard educational proficiency and demonstrated therapeutic proficiency. So that's why we started with, it's called the Clinical Sleep Health Navigator exam. And that's a credential that took many years to bring to fruition. But we're seeing the benefit of being very definitive in what defines what is commonly called a sleep coach. What are some of the credentials that are needed? What's the evidence for proficiency, hence an exam? And there's also a correlate of, there's an educational program, a standardized educational program we'll be rolling out with that. Mm-hmm. So we're very interested in making sure that our public is safe and that we're using the credentialing construct to say they have fulfilled the requirements of this exam, and therefore they practice within a structure that is overseen by the Board of Behavioral Sleep Medicine. So it's been an exciting, a lot going on, but remember, it's for the benefit of our community, our providers, and in the same, then we want to be certain that our patients are treated in a standardized, safe manner.
Right. Fantastic. You know, this we could go on for many hours on this, but we are out of time for this particular show. So what I'd love for you to do is, can you share with the audience, if they are a clinician or someone who's interested in potentially joining and would find value in the offerings, where can they go? And secondly, if they are someone who is a potential patient in need of assistance, is there somewhere they can go?
Yes, thank you. I like this part. First of all, let's talk about patients. If you have a sleep dysfunction, a sleep complaint, and you don't know where to go, our website, the Society of Behavioral Sleep Medicine, which is www.behavioralsleep.org, it has a contact us. That's me. Put your name, put your comments in there. It'll come to me. And then I will help direct you to a choice of providers where you can interview them, and you can decide who is in your area where you live. Do you want in person? Do you want telehealth? I can help guide you through that process. I don't do therapy. I am the engine behind getting you to where you need to go. And then if you want to join as a member, or if you want to participate in any of our other programs and you want to learn how to do that, again, go to the website, put your information in there, and contact us, and it'll come to me, and I'll help you. And I might even put you to work on a committee or on a project, because we do lots of projects that are really exciting. And they're also important for you if you're building your professional vita, and that's how you can advance through your career. So we're excited to have you, and we welcome you.
Great. Well, thank you so much for all this incredibly useful information. This is sort of a peek behind the scenes for the audience of what really goes on in the world of sleep medicine professionals, and especially behavioral sleep medicine professionals. So we're glad that you all were able to join us on this episode of Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. You can always find out more about Sleep Science Today at sleepsciencetoday.com. We have a new show every week. We look forward to seeing you here on our shows and learning how to improve your own sleep. And Catherine Hansen, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Sleep Science Today, your number one sleep authority.
Sleep Science Today.